We're still in the season of Epiphany, a time of theophanies, which is kind of a big word for God's sightings, God made manifest in and through Jesus and Jesus' earliest followers and through us. Tomorrow is Martin Luther King Jr. Day, a day of service and memory of Martin Luther King. It's interesting to think about this season of Epiphany, of God's sightings, of revelation and manifestation of God's presence, and Martin Luther King's purpose in the midst of that, his witness in word and deed with regard to justice, are manifestations of God's presence. This weekend, we remember God made manifest in and through Martin Luther King. Like Jesus in today's reading, Martin Luther King saw the signs of need all around him. In his case, it was the sins of racism and economic injustice in our country. And he spoke and acted on them, and like Jesus, eventually was killed for his discerning eye, his compassionate heart, his courageous action. This second Sunday after Epiphany, we're reminded in and through the life of Martin Luther King Jr. and also the reading we have from John's Gospel of the wedding of Cana. Hit Jesus' first moment of public ministry in John's Gospel. The wedding of Cana is the first of the signs of God's grace upon grace. And you'll remember a few weeks ago I talked about John's Gospel being the gospel of grace upon grace, the seven miracles or signs of God's presence with us, in and through us, and then finally the eighth through the resurrection and the ascension of Jesus. Some refer to the God sightings in John's Gospels as miracles, but if we think of them as miracles, then it takes us out of the equation. We see the event or what happened and not God behind it. The miracle itself is not the point or what we're supposed to see. John's Gospel asks that we see beyond the signs to God made manifest in everyday common events and people in us. Caroline Lewis, a professor of homiletics at Luther Seminary, writes that in John's Gospel, Jesus' signs show us, not just tell us, what God's grace looks like here on earth. And John's Gospel says what God's grace looks like and tastes like and feels like and smells like here on earth is turning water into wine. That's what it tastes like. The very best wine when you're expecting a so-so wine. John's whole gospel is a gospel of grace, grace upon grace. We have in John's Gospel Jesus' baptism, and then immediately Jesus calls a few disciples, and John then just swoops us into his public ministry. But for John, the first act of public ministry isn't political. It isn't about proclaiming or teaching or healing. It's an everyday life experience of common folks, a wedding feast in Cana. It's important for John to begin not where Mark and Matthew begin, but with the people. Because one of the important things about feasts, what they are good for, is to tending what's human in a person in a place where people get dehumanized. This Sunday, today, after our council meeting in which we go over the budget with a fine-tooth comb in preparation for bringing it to you next Sunday, we are also going to have a feast. And you know, you would think, aren't we finished with feasts? We've been through Christmas and New Year's, and we have our resolutions to tighten our belt, and here are other feasts upon us. But when the year's been hard, as last year was for the world, and sometimes for us as church, it's important to feast because it is dehumanizing. It reduces us to our smallest selves, our fearful and loathsome selves. And it's important to come together and feast together so that we can be made human together. And then tonight, our inward, outward spiritual direction group will meet and we will have another feast. We have gathered together for the last year and a half and we'll look at last year and the threshold experiences of last year and how God is being made manifest calling us forward in the new year. Feasts are good. They bring us back to ourselves and back to God. I suppose the wine that ran out at the wedding feast at Cana had been poured from wineskins, pretty small, holding maybe a quart or two of wine, but the water jars that Jesus used to hold the new wines were the ones prescribed for Jewish ceremonial washings. 6 stone water jars on hand, each one holding up to 25 gallons of wine. That is some party. And as one who last Sunday had to drink 4 liters of liquid, you know what I'm talking about, in preparation for a certain medical test, standard, nothing wrong with me. 4 liters is an awful lot. 144 gallons? Oh my gosh, I can't even think about that. They must have had to have a sleepover after that wedding. The wedding feast in Cana is what grace upon grace looks like. It's the antithesis of scarcity, a ton of wine, good wine, and when you least expect it. John Pilch, author of a series called The Cultural World of Jesus, gives us some understanding of the cultural context in ancient Mediterranean society for weddings. Weddings in ancient Mediterranean world were prearranged by parents for pre-selected partners. And these were usually relatives, often a first cousin, if there was one to be had. Most of the invited guests would also have been relatives, though in this instance, John's gospel tells us that the disciples were included. Maybe some of them were relatives too. But the fact that Mary did not hesitate to involve herself in the wedding in order to make sure the wine continued to flow smoothly meant that she and Jesus were probably related to the wedding party. Because otherwise, it would have been very shameful for a non-relative, a woman, to intervene as she did. Now, most of us mothers here, I think, can understand that exchange between Jesus and his mother. Mothers, can't you just hear this conversation? When the wine ran out, Mary says to Jesus, "They have no wine." In my family, my mother had a gift for stating the obvious, and her children were responsible for figuring out what that meant. She would say, "Your clothes are on the floor." And we knew what to do, and we knew the consequences of what would happen if we didn't. It took me a long time as an adult to realize that when someone says, "The book is on the desk," I wasn't supposed to do something with it. We didn't have to read each other's minds. Jesus replied in our text from the Inclusive Bible, "Mother, what does that have to do with me? My time has not yet come." Sound familiar? And actually, the Inclusive version of the Bible kind of cleans this up and makes it nice. "Mother," he calls her, but a better translation is "woman." Jesus calls his mother "woman." What does that have to do with me? My time has not yet come. You can almost imagine what happened between her saying that and then her turning to the servants saying, "Do whatever he tells you to do." I can just see the look on her face, can't you? Whatever, do whatever he tells you to do. She knew he would know the right thing. She was calling forth his best self. I want to talk a little bit about why Jesus treated his mother in that way. And I think it's really good news for our children to know that Jesus wasn't always such a good guy. A male's normal way of addressing a female he encountered in that time was "woman," not by her name. In fact, the women with whom I worked in Chiapas were not called by their name. And when I called them by their name, they were always startled because they had been called "woman." But calling his own mother "woman" would have been considered very unusual and disrespectful. There is no parallel to this usage in either Greek or Hebrew literature. Woman. Remember that in ancient Mediterranean culture, boys stayed with their mothers and the company of other women exclusively until they reached the age of 12. A strong relationship of enmeshment and what we would call today codependency developed between mother and son, especially only sons, the firstborn or the firstborn. That still happens today. Boys were spoiled by their mothers and other women around them. And so when at 12 they were thrust into the company of men, they had a rude awakening. The harsh hierarchical world was a sharp contrast to the women's nurturing and loving and encouraging from which the boy had just emerged. He was often forced to develop a male identity quickly and was quite often physically beaten harshly for falling back into women's ways. Unfortunately, that's still true today in some families. And we know men who have suffered that in moving from the care and nurture of their mother to a punishing presence of their father, or vice versa. These are not gender stereotypes. Either parent can be that, forcing a child to grow up too quickly, fitting into a mold that is certainly not what God had in mind for the child. As the boy grew into adulthood, he tried to weaken the strong emotional bond with his mother and most likely would demonstrate his independence from her by rejecting her claim upon him or the value of her word in general. Mothers, have you experienced that? Yeah. It's called differentiation with healthy children. But when it gets to the point of being disrespectful, extreme, habitual, then it becomes a problem and not God's plan for our sons or daughters. Why did Jesus give in? Maternal pressure was too hard for him to evade? Or maybe he didn't want to be presumptuous and intervene where he was not wanted, but then he did because his mother told him to? Or maybe he decided to take responsibility to preserve the family's honor. We don't know, but he did step into his power. Jesus and Mary's mother-son relationship was not so very different from mother-son relationships today. And men can be mothers too. Women can be fathers too. We have both of those within us, but in our culture, still we have those stereotypes of what mothers do and what fathers do. John the Evangelist tells us early on in his gospel that Jesus, quote, pitched his tent among us, end quote. If God in the flesh was sometimes like us, like Mary and like Jesus, we can imagine ourselves sometimes like them. The first week after Epiphany, we heard the stories of Jesus' baptism by John the Baptist in the River Jordan and the blessing of God the Father. You are my own, my beloved, on you my favor rests, at a threshold between his private and public life. This morning, we have the blessing of God the Mother. God needs Mary to mother Jesus. This week, we have an image of God the Mother in Mary, Jesus' mother who looks upon her son and sees his God-given potential and calls forth his best self. Now his mother is the instigator, initiator, who gets things rolling, not Jesus. Mary notices the need. There is not enough wine at the feast. She knows what needs to be done and who is to do it and calls out those who can. No more messing around with this Messiah complex. It's time to be who you are for the sake of the world. Story points out how important relationships are for God's forward movement. And I talked about this in Advent and Christmas, that sometimes we focus on the event or a person and we don't see how the relationships are necessary in order to move God forward. It's not about just you or me. It's about us. It's about moving God forward together. And in this instance, it is the relationship between mother and son that gets Jesus off his butt and gets him out in the world. And the world is changed because of that. John's mother gets Jesus. She knows him. She's watched him for 30 years. She, more than anyone in history, recognizes what Jesus is capable of doing. She initiates his act of public ministry. It's not his baptism. It's not the words from heaven. It's not the descent of the Holy Spirit. It is all of that, and finally the words of his mother. Epiphany brings to light the ways in which we see and know God, and the ways in which God grows in and through our relationships. It's not something that happens when we go it alone. As we say to each other in the end of our service, often we need each other to survive. We need each other to thrive. The theologian and author Marianne Williamson is another God-made manifest mother bear person. She writes, "Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. We ask ourselves, who am I to be brilliant, gorgeous, talented, and fabulous? Actually, who are you not to be? You are a child of God. Your playing small does not serve the world. There is nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people will not feel insecure around you. We are all meant to shine as children do. We were born to make manifest the glory of God that is within us. It is not just in some of us, it is in every one of us. And as we let our own light shine, we unconsciously give others permission to do the same. As we are liberated from our own fear," she writes, "our presence automatically liberates others." We need to be reminded who and whose we are, what God sees in us, not only individually but collectively, to be, to tell people who they are and what they can do, and to tell them, go, go. Who is the mother of Jesus in your life? Who helps you see who God sees you to be? Who tells you who you are? Who God has called you to be, who God needs you to be for the sake of the world. When we see and know each other as God sees and knows us, we call each other out of our own small and fragmented selves into our larger and whole selves. We need each other to survive. We need each other to thrive. Amen.